Blog Talk Radio.
When a parent lashes out at the other parent in front of a child, or simply says hurtful things about the other parent in front of a child, they are also attacking that child's sense of self-worth and confidence.
Dad says Mom doesn't really care about me and that she's lazy.
This is an act of alienation and is harmful to children and can cause a lifetime of issues for the child. Issues as serious as anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and thoughts of or actual suicide.
What did I do to make Mommy and Daddy so mad at each other?
Whether or not your child reaches his or her full and healthy potential in life rests in your ability to be mature and put them first.
I love you, Mom and Dad.
Help spread the word to educate and raise awareness. Visit www.paawareness.org to find out more.
Do help spread the word to educate and raise awareness. This is Jill Ajizi, and welcome to Family Matters. My co-host, Michelle Lawrence, is here with us today, back from her whirlwind tour of the Netherlands. Welcome, Michelle.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
I am so glad to have you here. We're going to talk in just a second about that exciting trip. And we were going to have with us tonight Dr. Linda Nielsen from Wake Forest University, a dear friend of mine and Michelle's, and she is going to be with us at a later date. We have Dr. Warren Farrell here. Welcome, Warren.
Hello. Glad to meet you.
We are so glad to have you here. I'm going to introduce you in just a second, but I want to say a couple of things. As we pointed out last time we had this show, when Michelle was off on her trip, I had been elected president of Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, and we are marching forward on our journey to make PAAO a household name. I'm sorry that we have to do that, but it is something that we need to create awareness and educate the public on what parental alienation is. So I will continue to do that. Michelle is in Chicago and Cook County being the great, outstanding, revolutionary judge that she is, but I want her to tell us tonight about her great trip to the Netherlands to visit our friend Ambassador to the Netherlands, Faye Levin. You presented in front of The Hague. Everybody is sitting on the edge of their seats waiting to hear all about that trip. Go for it.
So the answer is that even the people who are in the diplomatic corps, who live from all over the world, suffer the same way. There's really no difference. People are looking for skills to downgrade the pain of divorce. And in this particular case, since there were a lot of married people there, we really talked about the future of marriage and what are some of the new skills that are needed in the modern days. Marriage is not the same, which is why it's so perfect to have Dr. Farrell on today.
Absolutely.
But I want to say that I do know Dr. Farrell, and one of the things that I love about Dr. Farrell is that he gets so much into solution that he doesn't come from an anger place, even though there's lots of reasons to be angry if you don't have access to your children and if you're marginalized, but he goes through it deeply so that women who are doing the problem in certain cases can really understand what they're doing. It doesn't come from an angered place, so you don't shut down to it. I learned a lot of things from him that I use on the bench, to tell you the truth.
Well, and really, that's the basis to everything, is common sense, knowing what to say, knowing how to react to what's happening to you in that time of adversarial churning and horrible, you know, divorce court and all of the bad things that happen to you. It's knowing how to react to all of that,
yeah.
Isn't it?
I will say one interesting thing to everybody that I learned from the people that I talked to in Holland was that one of their grievances was that there never was any free time, that they always had to be accountable online through text and through constant email, not only with their bosses but with their spouses and their children, that there was no real conversation, and yet contact had to be around the clock. So there was no privacy, and I thought that was very interesting.
That is interesting, and I think it's interesting that you pointed out that this is happening all over the world, not only parental alienation, but horrible adversarial divorces happening all over the world, and people are looking for solutions. And the book we're talking about tonight, Dr. Farrell's book, Father and Child Reunion, a great portion of the book deals with the impact of disagreement, divorce, and false assumptions about dads predominantly. You know, I fight continuously against the fact that and had been lumbering under the assumption for so long that parental alienation was merely something that was happening to dads until it happened to me. And now I know that parental alienation is not a gender-based issue. It is about 50-50. And so Warren and I are going to have a little bit of disagreement on what his philosophy is, but I feel that it is not a gender issue. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. But the book explores issues from a multitude of aspects, including children, moms, wives, judges, attorneys, and the media. And if you're a parent who has experienced divorce, you have to take a look at this book. If you're currently going through a divorce, you must read this book. You've got to buy a copy for your attorney and let everybody know that this book is just an outstanding read. So, Warren, do you want to introduce Warren, Michelle? Since you've met Warren in person, why don't you do that?
Well, I don't have – Warren, help me out. I would like you to tell me all the books that you've written, because I've read your books.
Let's see. I wrote a book called Women Can't Hear What Men Don't Say, and that's a lot about communication and how, you know, and the underlying propensity of all human beings to respond defensively to personal criticism. And part of what I've done is to create a way to work around that. I basically say that it's biologically natural to respond to criticism, personal criticism from a loved one defensively, and that therefore we have to really develop an art and discipline of knowing how to work around that biologically natural response, to have not a natural response that's dysfunctional, but to have an unnatural response that is functional. And so that takes a huge amount of work, but it's really work that it, you know, saves us tens of thousands of hours and a great deal of angst and most likely either a legal divorce or a psychological divorce that gives people a great deal of pain. Another book was a book called The Myth of Male Power, and there I define power as control over one's life. And I'm basically saying that men had obligations and responsibilities throughout history just like women did. So if we talk to our grandparents or parents about women's rights or men's rights, they sort of roll their eyes and say, you know, adults know that grown-ups are, you know, a real man doesn't talk about rights, he talks about responsibilities and obligations, and a real woman does the same thing until recently. And so we really had, and so that there's an evolution from, and when people were talking about obligations and responsibilities as part of being a man or a woman, there was no real power in the sense of power being control over one's life. And so I by redefining power, I look at the myth of saying that men have the power, and I say that, you know, if we look at men, that men have often defined power as feeling obligated to earn money that someone else spends while they die sooner. And that's not really power.
Right. But can I brag about you? I have to. I'm just going to do it. You have been chosen by the Financial Times as one of the world's top 100 thought leaders.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite. And not to mention the 1,000 TV shows from Oprah to Larry King to being in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, but thought leaders, I mean, that's a pretty competitive field. So I hope that the listeners really, really pay attention to this, because if we start at the very beginning, could we start about this concept called father hunger? Could you tell us something about that? Because I'm starting from the birth, and we all believe that there's mothering instincts, but father hunger and fathering instincts, talk about that a little bit.
Yes, actually, let me start. Maybe one way, a good way of starting with that is just with the ad and with some of the parental alienation interests. One of the reasons that parental alienation is so damaging, no matter which gender it comes from, and it really doesn't make any difference what the ratio is, it's just that it's damaging. And one of the reasons it's so damaging is that when a child hears something negative about the other parent, the child is half of the genes of the other parent. And so the child starts looking in the mirror and seeing, and maybe the contact, the child doesn't have a lot of contact with the parent that is being criticized. As maybe, let's say, the parent is being criticized as being irresponsible or a liar or undependable or a cheat or something along those lines. And so that child tells a little fib to the mother and then looks in the mirror and sees the genes of, and sees the same body language as the mother has or the dad has, and who's ever being called the liar, the child begins to wonder, well, maybe I'm inherently a liar like my dad is or like my mom is. And it's sort of like an invasion of the psyche. And the child can't say, you know, to dad, you know, mom called you a liar, or to dad called you a liar. You know, is that true? Are you a liar? Are you inherently irresponsible? Do you always want to have sex with a lot of different people but not take care of any? You know, is that what you're about?
Right.
Because, you know, then the child only realizes that it's already worried about a destabilized environment from divorce, and that's only going to destabilize the situation even further. And so there's nowhere for the child to go with those fears, and then the child starts internalizing them, and from that internalization starts acting out. And so and having deep fears about himself or herself. And I think that's so when we, you know, as that ad implied, when you're criticizing the other parent, that's criticizing half the child. And if that other parent isn't around, that other parent that's being criticized becomes a straw parent, and that half of you that's being criticized becomes a straw child. You become a straw child. You only become a part of that half of yourself, and that's a part that you worry, like cancer, is eating away at you for fear that you are no good inside.
That you're exactly right, Warren, and something that I just want to read off of your website that is from the book, and this is just something that is kind of the mantra of parental alienation, that the child is half mom and half dad. The job of a child growing up is to discover whom it is. Who is it? Is it half mom and half dad? It is not the better parent. It is both parents, warts and all. So we are not talking about father's rights, mother's rights, or even the child's right to both parents. We are talking about a new paradigm, the child's right to both halves of itself. Psychological stability seems to emanate from the child knowing both parts of itself. And that is so incredibly important in a child's life.
Yeah.
So Warren, what do you do? What does the malign parent do when mom says you have a lot of girlfriends and that you care more about your girlfriends than you do about your children? How does a father defend themselves?
Yes.
Or the malign parent, whoever it is.
Yes, whoever the malign parent is a very fine line here. And the fine line is explaining your perspective on yourself and helping a child know but not putting the other parent down, because the second you put the other parent down, you start creating the problem in reverse. So how do you do that? The way you do that is to teach a child, what I do when I do couples communication workshops is I have a picture of one person, and then I have an artist's rendition of that person, which is like there are four different artist versions of that person. And what I explained to everyone in the group is that everybody sees everything. Everybody sees everybody through a different lens, that each person has a different story. So if the three of us get off this phone call and talk about this phone call to somebody else, we'll have three different stories about that phone call. Mm-hmm. And that it's important to teach a child from an early age that everyone it meets will have a different story, a different version about everything they do, about that day in class, about what it was like meeting you, about what it was like having that teacher. And so, and that mom has her version, and dad has his version, and mom will share her version, and mom's version and dad's version, you want to hear both of them, and then you will have a third version, and everybody and your sister will have a fourth version, and they're all things I want you to be able to hear. And once you start teaching a child that, it creates the foundation for many things. There's not just a Christian, there's also a Jew, and there's also a Muslim, and a Muslim and a Christian and a Jew all have their own Bible, their own story, their own version. And you start teaching tolerance by what could be a negative experience, you turn it into a tolerance experience.
I love that. So you could have an exercise. Divorced children should have an exercise. They should, with their siblings or with their friends, watch a TV show and then give their version, just so that they can see that it doesn't necessarily mean it's right, and it doesn't mean it's wrong.
That's absolutely right, and DVR that TV show, so you can go over it, because the TV show says one thing, but there are so many versions of the way that you can look at that TV show and what it says, even though it's in black, you know, it's in color or black and white, it's so clear on one level, but yet it's so unclear or so magnificently different by everyone. Everyone brings their own enriched life experience to that experience. You know, for example, if a German person says the mountain, in German the mountain is feminine, and in French the mountain is masculine. And so, and when you ask people to make up a cartoon in which a German or a French person speak about the mountain, the French person will color that mountain and have it verbalize itself in a cartoon in a feminine way, or the masculine way, and the German in a feminine way. And so, even through the languages we develop different images of things that are so neutral as a mountain.
Warren, there's a question from the chat room that I'd like to ask you from Cindy. How much should a target parent share with others? How much should they share with others that they think could possibly help them and their children? And what do they say to people who say, what do you want me to do to help you?
Well, let's see. If the question is about, like talking to, are you interpreting the question as like talking to friends about the divorce you're going through? Is that?
Well, I think what she's asking, because I know this particular person is an alienated parent, so I think what she's asking is, what should the target parent who is alienated from her children say to others who ask, how can I help? How can I intervene in your situation? How do you respond?
Yeah, I think the best thing that friends can do, is that what you mean, like friends?
Yeah, exactly.
The best thing that friends can do, first of all, the best thing that friends can do is just plain listen empathetically and not say things like, you know, that I've always felt that you were worthy of somebody better than John or, you know, or Jill. You know, well, I actually always said John and Jill, I just realized your name is Jill.
Or Michelle.
Yes, Michelle, right.
Me out of it.
I was doing like a Jack and Jill type of thing here. let's see. But I was meaning Jill metaphorically, figuratively, not literally.
Right. But I mean, like an aunt calling the child and say, your mom misses you, and what are you doing? And, you know, like that kind of thing. The relatives all want to say, should I talk to your children?
Yes, the relatives should talk to the children, and just the important thing that the relatives need to do is, you know, share their desire to be with the child and be with the child as often as possible, and talk with the child and communicate with the child, and have, you know, and do video Skype. Especially now we have the technology to do video Skype. Every child of divorce, I believe, should have a video Skype set up whenever possible. If you have a laptop, get a laptop with video Skype and communicate with your family and friends. The more, especially your family, because your family will be there for a lifetime. And when you are in a divorce situation, your big risk is stability. and knowing that you have support from people is really important. And every single person in that family unit should know that it's not okay to talk negatively about anybody. If that person, if that aunt or uncle is spoken negatively about, it is fine for him or her to defend or give their perspective on themselves, and ideally from the perspective that I just mentioned a minute ago.
Perfect.
Well, just spinning off of Cindy's thing, in my courtroom, I will have children who, if under fear of having to see one of their parents, will amp up their psychological difficulties around, you might have to see your mom or you might have to see your dad, and before you know it, you have the children talking about suicide. This happened, a handful of times. So I never know. I'm very interested in when a child goes into their own personal drama about it.
What I have seen about suicide, and one of the things, because men commit suicide four times as often as women do, therefore suicide, and my mom committed suicide, I've, sort of taken more than just a normal interest in that. And one of the things that I've seen is that there seems to be four things that coexist that all together have to happen before a person commits suicide. And that is, one of those is feeling that nobody loves you, another that nobody needs you, that there's no hope of that changing, and that you don't have good skills about talking to other people about your feelings, other people who you feel will listen to you. And when all four of those things coexist, then you have you're a candidate for suicide at a much higher level than you are otherwise. Of course, there will always be individual personalities that will be subject to that, based on genetics. But other things being equal, those are the crucial issues to be aware of.
Warren, I got to tell you, I just want to say this. Most of the people in the chat room tonight, I would say 98% are women. And I think you're missing.
I'm sorry, I have lost you.
You lost me. Can you hear me now?
I don't know if you can hear me.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you, but I'm
okay.
Great.
I was telling you that most of the people in the chat room right now are women. And what I want to say to you is do another book, because there are so many women out there who are hurting just as badly as the gentleman. Now, I know that it's a little bit higher percentage for men with divorce, but when The Look of Love, my novel about parental alienation and divorce, came out in January, that week I received 463 emails from non-custodial, mostly moms, who were frightened to speak out because they didn't know there were other people like them and the stigma attached to being a mom without her children. So there are plenty of women out there that are going through this very same thing as I am, as an alienated parent. And it is a horrible, horrible thing and I was a custodial mom, to not have your children. So I just want you to know that they're out there, and I know that you've done tons of research, and I know you've talked to tons of guys, but boy, these ladies are out there and they're hurting just as badly. And is the suicide rate as high? I don't know what the statistics are on that, but I can tell you that I talk all day sometimes to women who are alienated from their children, and the depression that I feel from them and the sadness is devastating.
Actually, that's a whole other topic. I was talking about children leveraging the court to try and align with the alienating parents. And whether or not
I know what you were talking about.
Okay.
I'm just telling Warren something that I feel.
Yes, absolutely. And yes, the children, very good. I totally agree with you about that, Jill, and I think that there is, I do want to say that what women are doing when they're talking with you is solving the problem. The very fact that they hear that somebody is, and what the good news about women, part of the multitude of good news is about women, is that women do talk. Women talk with each other. Mm. Women talk with you. Women call into shows. They call into chat rooms. They read books. When there's a divorce, they're 45% more likely than the male is to reunite with their family in a much closer way. They're about, you know, 8 or 9 times as likely as men to have the children and to feel needed. Now, does this mean they're not hurting? It certainly does not mean they're not hurting. There's no one that survives a divorce without feeling like I'm a failure, what's wrong with me, you know, everything that I've built. They deal with money issues, but they deal mostly with feel, you know, everyone, as Michelle says so eloquently, you know, they walked up an aisle together, promising and hoping to have a lifetime together that was going to be forever. And, you know, and no one says it better than that Michelle does in the introduction of her book. And then suddenly seeing this person that you, whose hand you once held, now holding on to court documents ready to sue you. I mean, the pain in that, no matter whose court, who that is enormous for everyone, absolutely.
Michelle.
You know, can I tell you what the bane of my existence on the bench?
Yes, tell
I'm going to tell you, the bane of my existence is fathers who don't show up. And here's why it's difficult. And maybe you, Warren, can tell me about that. Because this is, I've just taken a little bit of a left turn, but I don't want the show to go without reaching out to those people who are, who, the fathers, and it could be mothers, who are so shut down because they hate the process and they hate the courts and they hate the lawyers. And I can't, sometimes you can't get through to people who just say, well, there's another guy living there now. They don't need me. And who don't come for years. What part of them shuts down? What happens there?
Yes, first of all, we live in a culture which doesn't teach, we don't teach our sons how important they are to children. We do teach our sons a lot about, you know, we flash in front of them millions of images of attractive women with fewer and fewer clothes on, and that stimulates their sexual desire. But that's only the part that creates the child. We don't,
yeah.
You know, we don't teach them in kindergarten, first, second, third, 10th grade, which we should be doing, how crucial a child is, a father is to a child's life, how crucial his or her father is to their life. And that's where it, you know, begins. We have to really change our culture, because mom is home with the child more frequently than dad is. We don't say, you know, even though dad doesn't necessarily cook your meal, here is what dad provides. What does dad provide? Dad is more likely to, when you fall down on the ski slope, to encourage you to get back up again. And mom is more likely to hold you and say, okay, I see that you're hurt. And what, who do you need? You need mom to hold you, to see that you're hurt, to let you cry. And you also need dad to encourage you to get back up and try again. You want to climb a tree. Mom is more likely to say, sweetie, not now. In a couple of years, you can climb the tree. Dad is more likely to say, okay, but be careful, and then sort of half watch the child. From dad, you get the encouragement to take risks and to try new things, and that develops your brain in ways that it wouldn't be if you didn't take those risks. From mom, you get the encouragement to sort of watch out for yourself to a greater degree. When mom and dad have an argument together, what are they doing? They're like Republicans and Democrats. They're checks and balances to each other. And we all sense that whether we're a Republican or a Democrat, that the country may, the Republicans may hate the Democrats and vice versa, but we all sense that the two-party system having checks and balances is better to govern our country. And moms and dads together respecting each other's contribution and teaching our children to know the knowledge, to know about the contribution of both fathers and mothers, keep that's the groundwork that needs to be planted in children at an early age in order for children who are boys who grow up to say, I am indispensable in this process. When I met the woman who became my wife, it was about 16 years ago. And I was writing the first draft of Father and Child Reunion, and her husband, the father of my stepchildren now, had not been involved in the raising of the children. He had moved away, and he read the first draft of my book, and he came back and said, I want to be involved in the raising of the children. And we arranged it so that an addition was built onto the home that my wife was living in, and that was and it was that he moved into to be close to the children.
Wow,
that is my favorite part of your book, Warren.
Is that right? Oh,
I love your foreword to the book because it's all about that, and it is amazing that you three work together to make those children comfortable in their skin.
But what would you say that it was because he had an aha moment because you broke it down for him? Or was it because he saw you as somebody that would be, you know, open and warm to his flaws and not judge him for what he'd done? I mean, how is there something in that that I can't tell you how many fathers come, you know, that and I say, you know, they come to get the divorce and I say, how long since you've seen your child? Well, 7 years. Have you tried? Do you know about parent locator services that we can find the mom to the Social Security number? No, it's all right. I just never can figure that out. While I'm on the bench, I just want to understand what shuts down for people. Are they in so much pain they have to shut down? Or are you just saying they never grew up to be adult men and understand the responsibility?
Men are really good about doing things when they're told they have a purpose. And we take little pieces of leather and run it 100 yards and risk spinal cord injuries because we're told that we'll be loved, liked, appreciated by the people for getting this little piece of leather across the goal line. So what boys need to know when they're young and what young men, fathers need to know, when I talk to fathers about the fact that, you know, here are the purposes you serve. Are you aware that probably you enforce boundaries differently than the mom does? And you know, in the book, I have an example of peas and ice cream that after divorce very frequently. There's the father, a mom after divorce will say to a child that you can't have your peas until you finish your ice. I mean, you can't have your ice cream until you finish your peas. Dad will say the exact same thing. The child after divorce will usually say something like, you know, well, you know, I had this, can I have these? I'm going to have a few more peas, Mom. I just had these few peas. Now can I have my ice cream? And Mom will tend to think to herself, well, gee, I can't deny the ice cream even though I said he should finish the peas until you have the ice cream. I don't want to get into a big fight about a few peas when we only have a few precious moments before I put him to bed or her to bed. And so the mom tends to say, okay, I'll tell you what, and negotiate maybe a pea or two more, and then say, okay, now you can have your ice cream. Whereas Dad tends to look at the same situation and say, excuse me, you know what the deal is? I know what the deal is. You have a choice here. You can either have your peas and have your ice cream or not have all your peas and not have your ice cream. And so the child with the mother will tend to sort of learn a lesson. And the lesson is, I don't have to focus and pay attention to what I need to do. I'll just focus on getting and negotiating a better deal. With the father, the child learns, I cannot negotiate a better deal. I need to finish what I need. I need to pay attention to what I need to do in order to get what I want. And so children growing up with dads are much less likely to have ADD or ADHD. That is, they're forced to pay attention to what they need to do in order to get what they want to do. Now, a dad has to know that his difference in style has a purpose. And when he sees that and he's not just being criticized for being mean to the child and unempathetic, and not understanding the child's need for love and support, he has a different way of loving and supporting that child. And his way is needed as part of the child's growing up. He may be too much that way, and that's why it's so important for the mother to be in the picture. But the child needs both that protection, that love, that nurturance, that support, and also that you need to finish this project before you need to finish what you need to do before you get what you want to do. And the dad needs to know that his methods are what helps the child make the transition from immediate gratification to postponed gratification. And that journey from immediate gratification to postponed gratification is the single most important transition that one has in the growing up process, to going from a child to a grown up.
And Michelle, you've talked so many times about how you deal with divorcing parents in your courtroom when they have children, and you want to make these people feel like you've made an investment in their future. So you are doling out different tasks that each parent, I mean, you talk about that philosophy that you have when you want to invest in a parent's future for their children.
Well, I think I'm eating the peas for them, but that's a nice story.
You love peas.
I think this is a question of the court system, and the question of people really needing to be heard. And if people are not, if you don't fear the court system quite as much, and I think that people can do this with each other. I mean, the book is so that people can do it with each other and not need the court and use the lawyers for law and not to battle out their emotions. But, you know, I just show them that agreements can be had on small things. And if agreements can start on small things and they can be heard in a way that they can hear each other for the first time, because I have an advantage, though, Jill and Warren, and that is, I ask somebody a question they kind of have to answer. So if I ask someone to say why they're so terrified to give overnight visits on Wednesday, they're going to say, and maybe dad or mom will hear for the first time what's really going on. The whole divorce process is all about how you're heard. And then someone else can address your needs. People push on each other a template of the most fearful process, which in many cases it is, and people react from terror. And when you react from terror, you're saying no to the parent all the time because you're afraid give an inch, they'll take a mile. And, you know, you're not thinking clearly. I can help them think a little more clearly. I have that advantage, and I try and write ways that people can do that for themselves. I think that's what you asked.
Yeah, that's what I asked.
That's
exactly what I asked. Warren, what do you feel about that?
Yes, I think that the single most important investment we can make to minimize the pain of divorce is to teach people how to communicate. And what I mean by that is everybody believes in communication, but I have literally never met a person who knows how to communicate effectively without extensive training to do so. And what I mean by that is that I've never met somebody that can hear personal criticism given by a loved one without becoming defensive.
Right.
And that is the key, that we are biologically trained when we hear criticism because of our history and kinship networks and communities, that when people outside of that kinship network or community criticize us, we fear that that person criticizing us or those people criticizing us might be the enemy. So what was the natural response to an enemy? To get up our defenses, to defend against the enemy possibly killing us, or even better, to kill the enemy before we kill them. And when we're criticized by our partner, a loved one, the fear is that they're going to become the enemy, that we get our defenses up naturally. I mean, we don't even have to logically fear that they're going to become the enemy. We just naturally respond to that criticism by getting our defenses up or sidestepping the bullets and killing the enemy before the enemy kills us. And of course, that was useful for survival. It is just absolutely dysfunctional for intimacy because it makes every person in a relationship feel like they're walking on eggshells. And so people, when they first meet each other, see this, you know, they give each other awe training. The woman is saying to the man, oh, you're in real estate? My God, that's amazing. The guy is saying to the woman, my goodness, you are a judge and you care about communication. That's phenomenal. But 10 years later, they're sort of interrupting or, you know, tuning out or and they learn that there's different things that we are that they shouldn't talk about because that can get into trouble. So they start cutting off more and more areas of communication and eventually more and more areas of themselves. And they're going to bed at night with a person that they love for life, but yet they fear talking to on so many levels, and so little pieces of themselves are going to bed with each other. And then that becomes the basis for feeling hurt and angry and alienated, even though you're with the person that you love.
If I was to tell you the single greatest exacerbator of the breakdown of relationships in anger, it's when people are going through a divorce and one of the people bring in either a girlfriend or a boyfriend before the divorce is over or even after. Visitation could be going smoothly until the new person comes on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm asking you if you have some suggestions for how people who have connected, usually before the other party's connected, and they're paying a price because all of a sudden visitation gets interrupted. How would they respectfully handle that with their ex-spouse or soon-to-be ex-spouse?
Yes, it's a really, really good question, and there's two different experiences there. When dads, males need purpose, and so if they discern that they can get when a male is married to a woman, and his initial sense is that if I earn money, I will get love, and so that's his fantasy, that's his dream, that's his hope, that's his incentive for earning money. In most traditional families, or even quasi-traditional families, if he doesn't earn money, you know, the woman will marry the substitute husband, get a government check. But in terms of if he earns money, he will get the love of his family. That's his promise. When divorce occurs, that's the end of that promise. His dream is being swept away, and so the fear is that he will not get that love. But if a woman says to him, you're needed as growing up, and instead of telling you when Joey and Jane come over to your house, instead of telling you here's what you need to do and then checking to see whether you're doing it right and treating you like a babysitter, I trust that your raising of the children in your way, albeit different than mine, is going to be an important contribution to the child. When men have that type of purpose, they have less need to find women to love. When a man gets a divorce, he's 10 times as likely as a woman is to commit suicide. And to prevent himself to commit, and because he feels nobody loves him, nobody needs him. If the woman is the person likely to have the child and likely to be gatekeeping with him, he's more likely to feel he needs another source of love. He can't have the children, so he goes off and finds another woman. Who does he find in that other woman? He finds a woman that usually wants children, either has children or wants children. And so that woman gives him, that new woman gives him an incentive to pour his love into that new family. And therefore, and that sort of makes him torn between the new family and the old family. And so that's one of the things that we really need to help men and women understand is one of the reasons for keeping male involvement, father involvement, so equal and so fully involved is so that the father doesn't drift into another woman, another family, and another source of love.
Warren, can you tell me, you've done research all over the world, and the dynamic in the United States is a little bit different than other countries, maybe not Australia, because it's very strange there. But what do you find a country that doesn't have the divorce dynamic that we have, that it's different, that people deal with things differently?
Very minimally. Michelle's comment at the beginning of the program was really right on, that you know, things in Holland there's a lot of similarities, and the division is between industrialized countries and non-industrialized countries. Non-industrialized countries, the poorer you are overall, the tighter the family. The wealthier you are, the more you seek options. so as you seek options, you tend to travel further, go further, and become less needy of your family. Needy is not meant in a negative way, just
right.
You tend to be less in need of very tight family bonds. And so so in industrialized societies, there's enough margin for error. There is the luxury of being able to divorce. And then when there's a divorce in all industrialized nations, the basic dynamic is the same. And that dynamic is, to a much greater degree, women fantasize from an earlier age in most societies, in industrialized societies, marriage and, the prince marries the princess. And so when Princess Diana got married, 2.3 billion people watched that on TV. About 85% of those people watching for an elongated period of time were women. And, when that fantasy, every day the female equivalent of pornography is People magazine and other types of cosmopolitans where,
right.
where the fantasy is, the man, the woman marrying the prince or the rich person. And when the guy looks at that and he sees a woman marrying a prince, he feels like he's coming up short a castle. And just like when a woman sees a man watching pornography, she feels she comes up short in a number of ways as well. And so those things create feelings of inferiority on the part of the other gender. But those basic dynamics, a woman falling in love with the dream of being swept away. When she's divorced, that dream of being swept away is being swept away. And so that's a fundamental disappointment that happens for almost all women. Women don't get the same socialization when they're younger about being rejected. When boys are adolescents, the commerce of male adolescence is the trading of wood-covered put-downs. We reject each other all the time. When we take risks of asking women out on dates, we get about 100 to 150 risks of rejection between eye contact and intercourse. When we play baseball or football, we're constantly rejecting each other and putting each other down. Males have a much greater experience as they grow up of being rejected. When women are getting married to somebody who they feel will love them and give them security for life, and when there's a divorce that occurs, they're not as prepared for that experience of rejection, and men need to understand that. It's not just about them. It's about that a woman's experience of rejection is not as deeply ingrained into her socialization as your experience of dealing with rejection is.
And the loss of the dream for the woman.
The loss of the dream.
It's probably one of the great reasons for anger, because not only sometimes people blame the spouse for the loss of the dream, but can't imagine that they'll ever be able to get that dream again, and it re-alters their connection with the world and their sense of purpose.
Absolutely. And, when I married, but I married a second time, this is my second and last wife, when I got divorced from my first wife, and I sat down, and my wife and I sat down and told my dad. My dad said, "I want you to know that you will never feel about anybody the same way as you felt about Ursie, your first wife." And the reason for the and he didn't really explain completely why. But as I get older, I realize that there's a lot of truth to that, because when I got married the first time, I had an innocence, and when I got married the second time, that innocence was not the same as it was the first time. And when you get married in innocence and you keep that and nurture that, and women get married in a greater abundance of innocence and focus on the dream of being swept away. And that dream of being swept away, as I said, with divorce, comes from being swept away. Now, when I say this, a lot of men say to me, "Well, Warren, I don't get this. She initiated the divorce." And so,
yeah.
But that misses the point. And I say to the dads, whether she didn't initiate the divorce because she wanted to initiate the divorce and end the dream. She initiated the divorce because things that she wanted, things that she believed were part of marriage, were not happening. And neither you nor she had the tools to make them happen. And so what we need to do is to develop those tools to make them happen. Grammar school and junior high school and high school need to be about giving our children relationship tools, communication tools, marriage tools, understanding how to raise children tools, understanding what the importance of both genders are. Until that happens, law courts can never solve the problem because, as Michelle and I agree, law courts are about binary decisions, win or lose. There's nothing more nuanced than human relationship. No law can keep up with the nuance and subtleties of how people hurt each other. When a woman asks a man to pay attention to him and he's paying attention to a sporting event, he is initiating a divorce.
Are you saying, I'm sorry, Jill, did you want to ask something?
No, I'm just saying that Warren is saying to reconfigure the dream, and that's what we need to do for children, because in today's society we have to reassess what the nuclear family is and what the desire of young men and young women are, and educate them to what they are to expect. And I know, Michelle, you quote this so many times, that 48% of divorced children don't want to get married.
Right. I just have to go back to this. Warren, are you suggesting that if a guy has a woman, or a woman takes up with the guy before the divorce is over, or even after the divorce is over, that if at all possible, there should be a conversation that goes something like this? Yes, I'm with someone else, but it will never replace the innocence and the time we spent together. There will be nothing like it. And yes, I love this other person, but I still hold sacred that time we spent together?
Well, first of all, that would be a very good thing to say. And yet, I'm also saying that if you give that man purpose when you divorce and you say, you are needed in your child's life, and I understand why you are needed in your child's life, I understand that you are more... whatever, and then she describes the differences in his child-rearing styles as his contributions that she is not as prone to make as he is, as opposed to describing his differences as the part of the reason for her divorcing him. It can be very true that the very reasons you may be divorcing your husband may be things about him that, when applied to the child, like, you know, boundary enforcement that you may think is meanness, we were talking before with, in relation to the peas and the ice cream, that those things can be contributions to the child's development. But we have nothing in this culture that teaches a woman to say that these things about your style that are different than mine are things the children value, the children need. And when a father hears that, he is much more likely to stay involved with the mother. In fact, if the mom had that style, the chances of him wanting a divorce to begin with would be much, much less. And if the man has the style of when a woman is, you know, when he's watching that sports event and the woman asks a question, he, you know, clicks off the TV, listens to the question, pays attention to the question, and gives a full answer and hears her, she's much less likely to file for divorce to begin with. So it's those underlying things that are really important. By the time it gets to the law court, we can only put Band-Aids on it.
And if she listened like that, they'd be less likely to say, see you in court after you call the lawyer to make sure you get her or his attention.
Absolutely. Basically, the lawyer is one of the most expensive listening sources in the world. I mean, the degree to which you need to hire a lawyer is the degree to which you need to look in the mirror and say, I am paying a very high price for not working hard on being able to communicate.
But Warren, how do you get to that point? I mean, there's so many people out there who are so angry and looking for emotional justice. How do you get to the point where you can make these statements to your soon-to-be ex or ex-spouse?
Well, I think first you may need to go to a psychologist and have a psychologist work with you. you may need to wait some time to let a certain amount of healing be done. And ideally, when if you're hearing this now, when fathers usually call me to get involved to be equally involved with their fathers, for me to do expert witness work to get them equally involved with their children is what I meant to say. I say, is there any hope whatsoever of you and your wife doing work learning how to communicate effectively with each other? And the great majority of time he says no, and I say, my response is, are you sure of that? Have you asked her? Have you said that you're willing to? And sometimes he says yes, and sometimes he says no. And sometimes he says, I know her well enough, she wouldn't possibly do it. Other times he says, I've already asked that. But, it's really important for both of you to say, I am open to going to counseling and learning how to handle your perspective. The difficulty is that many counselors serve as quasi-mediators, where the father and the mother are trying to persuade the counselor that they are better than the other person is. And if you have that type of counselor, you're missing the point. The purpose of good counseling is to teach people how to have the other person become a hero, and for you to be able to, your partner to become a hero, or your future ex to become a hero, how to see their story and hear what they're feeling and how they're hurting. When you learn that skill, you have the skill of knowing how to really love.
Oh.
So the worst thing you could do is start divorce proceedings by surprising somebody with sheriff's service of papers, isn't it?
Oh, my God, yes. And, your world...
Doesn't that start off the trouble when you don't sit down?
Well, this trouble starts off. That's just a good example of how the trouble gets, magnified by 10. But, the trouble starts off, I hope... the listener is hearing that the trouble starts off each time we don't hear our partner's story, or each time we try to make our story win over our partner's story. The second we need to win, there's no such thing as winning. It's we either both figure out a way of winning together, or when either sex wins, both sexes lose, and the family boat sinks.
Well, we've got about 3 minutes left, and this show has gone so incredibly fast. And Dr. Farrell, Warren, I thank you so much for being here with us today. And I want you to give us some contact information for you, where we can buy the book. And I want to ask you if you would come back again and finish up, because I feel like we could go on for hours. And so if you would be our guest again, we would love that.
Well, I certainly would be happy to be. And the book that we've been sort of focusing on is Father and Child Reunion. And probably the fastest way to get that is just to go on Amazon and check out Father and Child Reunion, or check out warrenferrell.com. And the Farrell is F as in Frank, A-R-R-E-L-L, two L's in Farrell, warrenferrell.com. And that the book is available through the website, but also through Amazon.
And Warren, you also do some expert testimony as well.
Expert testimony and my ideal
workshops.
My ideal would be to have somebody come to one of my couples communication workshops and never have to do expert testimony with anybody.
Absolutely.
I know, but feel that way too.
Well, my dream is to have Warren come here and work with divorcing couples in a workshop. That's my dream that I don't want to be swept away.
I want that to be my dream too. That
would
be our
dream.
We will work towards that then, Michelle. And I want to talk about quickly your book, The Good Karma Divorce, which is just an outstanding tool for divorcing couples. Tell me just quickly about the book.
It's a different formula for getting people through a divorce, saving their own souls and the souls of their children. And it's my view from the bench about what people do and how they can do it differently on every level, emotional, spiritual, as seen through what can be done in the courts and what can't.
And you can get that at Amazon or the Good Karma.
And not
Divorce.
To just like we're promoting ourselves, but just to say that The Look of Love is a very important book to me, because it's what happens, and it's the story about what happens when people forget that they have to take care of their children first.
That's right. The Look of Love, my novel, which is available on Amazon and my website as well, thelookoflovebook.com. Thank you again to my lovely co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence, and to Dr. Warren Farrell for being here with us tonight. We have had a great show, and we will do this again. So, Warren, we will be calling you.
Thank you so much, Warren.
Oh, it's wonderful being with the two of you. I look very forward to coming out to Chicago and doing more together.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Takes my breath away. I can only